Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, August 17th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the from the editor's column. Now, for the cover story, here's what I'm going to do. What they have is on the front cover, it says, "As back to school bells ring, a spotlight on education," which means I got a whole pile of articles about that. So I'll skip that until later. So I'll move on and I'll read Our World and Reporters on the Job. I won't read the explainer because it's all graphics. And I won't read the home forum because it's a picture with a little paragraph telling you what's in the picture. And I won't read the editorials. So skip that. So then I will read the from the collection of articles that is referred to as Back to School Bells Ring, a Spotlight on Education. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor's column is entitled The Real Lessons of Back to School. This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who's the print editor, and you can email her at Haynes at H-A-N-E-S-S at csmonitor.com. And she writes, "There was a short chapter in my life when I was not concerned with going back to school. It was post-college, pre-children, and I remember the smugness of planning a vacation for early October. For what felt like forever, my late summers had revolved around number two pencils and class lists and the prickly anticipation sparked by names like Western Civilization or Biology 2. But then the months sprawled like a teenager in a hammock. And I won't lie, the break was nice. After a while, though, I realized a bit of me was ready for back to school again. This was before I had kids of my own, before they hoisted pint-sized backpacks and picked out special polka-dot leggings to wear for the first day. I just realized I missed September's sense of potential, not in that self-focused way of many New Year's resolutions, but as an expansive sort of longing for new things to learn and a new relationships to forge. That's where this special issue comes in. If you've experienced any of this, whether you are returning to school yourself or whether it's been decades since you thought about meeting a new teacher, this magazine is for you. Throughout these pages, our stories tackle some of the most debated topics in education today, from artificial intelligence to college finances. They also delve into the connections we make in the classroom, whether interspecies or international. Be sure to check out our special kids space. I won't. We designed it so you can pass it to the younger children in your life. In a lot of ways, the modern education system is an odd experiment. We take children away from their families, group them by age, and attempt to teach them a set of facts we think they all should know, from geometry to Shakespeare. So it's not surprising, perhaps, that the real lessons are not always about coursework. We asked children and teens at Camps Newfound and Owatonna in Maine for their best tips for day one at school. You'll find many of them sprinkled on the pages throughout this magazine. But here's a sample. Talk to people who look like they need a friend. Don't do things just because other people do it. And don't try to take it all in at once. Also, don't worry so much. And don't stress over grades that won't matter in the end, but still try. Don't miss out on experiences. This, I realize, is what I had missed most about back to school, and it's this sense of humanity alongside learning that we hope you continue to find in our magazine." And that was the From the Editor's column, and it was entitled, it was written by Stephanie Haynes, print editor, and it was entitled The Real Lessons of Back to School. And now for Our World in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a global news roundup compiled by the Monitor's international team. The first one here is Russia and Ukraine trade strikes on warehouses. Russia and Ukraine have been attacking each other's major logistics and retail warehouses, claiming the companies sell military gear for troops on the front lines. At least 10 centers operated by Russian retailer Wildberries were hit during July, causing severe economic losses. According to the independent news outlet Medusa, Wildberries has responded by scrubbing references to equipment, including helmets, body armor, and drones, from some of its online search results. Such goods were formerly offered to a dedicated page on the site. Russia's Ozon and logistics hubs operated by Ukraine's Nova Pushta have also been accused of acting as conduits for military equipment. And that was written by Fred Weir. Our next one, a maritime arms race on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea has announced plans to launch a next-generation submarine by the mid-2030s, to be named after Jang Bogo, a naval commander from the 9th century. The nuclear-powered submarine will be quieter and faster and have a longer range than older diesel-electric subs from the 1990s. And it's meant to counter North Korea, which says it is developing its own nuclear-powered submarines. Experts say it's not clear whether Pyongyang has the nuclear know-how to put a naval reactor on an operational vessel. And that was written by Matthew Bell. The next one, the truth is coming to light. That's Balwinder Singh, a Sikh religious leader, commenting on the Indian biographical film Satluj to the Associated Press. The film, which describes killings and mysterious disappearances amid a government crackdown during the Punjab separatist insurgency in the 1980s and 1990s, was removed from a streaming platform in India after undergoing many cuts by government censors. Residents in Punjab state now stream copies of the movie at community screenings in Sikh temple courtyards and village halls. Everything happened right before our eyes, so what is there to oppose? Added Mr. Singh. That was written by Kalena Onukwuga. And the last one here. No prison will silence the feeling of hope we have stirred. That's what an AI-generated avatar of Jair Bolsonaro, Brazil's former president, said in a video played at a political rally in Sao Paulo in late July. Mr. Bolsonaro, under house arrest over his role in an attempted coup, wasn't present at the rally where his son, Flavio, launched his own presidential campaign July 25, 2026, but critics say the 46-second video clip violated electoral rules banning deepfakes. Jair Bolsonaro's sentencing also bars him from disseminating political or electoral messages. Brazil's top court was hearing a legal challenge at press time. That was written by Whitney Ulick. And there's a little note here. Have an idea for Our World? Please email ourworld@csps.com. If there is an important global story that the media missed, a trend that is driving the news where you live, or a story that uplifts, the Monitor will publish reader picks from time to time. And next up is Reporters on the Job. And they don't even label it as such. But anyway, it is a map of the world with points indicated on it and a paragraph about each point. So, from where is this one from? From Washington. This is written by Caitlin Babcock. The halls were bustling outside the Senate floor where I was reporting on government shutdowns. The clack of dress shoes on marble floors echoed through the corridors as reporters approached lawmakers, black-clad servers carried food to luncheons, and teenagers wandered through the halls. The Capitol may be the seat of legislation, but it's also a classroom. During spring break season, I often plan alternate routes to avoid hallways filled with students on field trips. Observing the Senate floor recently, I was joined by a troop from Scouting America learning about governance. Moments such as these remind me that the Capitol belongs to all Americans. Our next one is from Newcastle, Delaware, and it's written by Ira Porter. As the Monitor's higher education reporter, I've seen the challenges facing colleges recently through my reporting, including at an Education Writers Association seminar in Baltimore and in conversations with faculty and students. Temple University laid off 40 employees and announced a projected $85 million budget deficit. Syracuse University offered voluntary retirement packages to 175 employees and eliminated or paused 93 academic programs. Howard University unenrolled 502 students who missed financial aid deadlines before re-enrolling some and extending deadlines. The One Big Beautiful Bill will make college more expensive by capping and eliminating financial aid programs. I'll be following these changes closely and writing about what they mean for higher education. The next one is from Mexico City, and it's written by Whitney Ulick. And she writes, I reported on education in Latin America for years before enrolling my own children in school in Mexico. I was familiar with the regional norm of the double shift, where some children attend school in the morning for 4 to 5 hours, and another group comes in the afternoon. It was popularized in the 1950s as a way to bring more children into the education system. What I wasn't prepared for, however, were the short school days, even in schools without a double shift. My kids get out around 1:30 p.m., World Bank research shows that longer hours at school don't automatically mean more learning, but longer days can increase female labor force participation, something I think about every time my kids knock on my office door around 2 p.m. to tell me how hungry or bored they are. And before I read the next one, here's one of these things where they ask kids some advice about school. And this one is, what is your most important tip for someone going into a new school? And the answer, you should observe how things run, schedules, etc. Make connections with your teachers. Take it one step at a time. And that was from Caroline, who is going into 10th grade. Okay, back to reporters on the job. This is from Slovyansk, Ukraine, and it's written by Scott Peterson. I had twice written for the Monitor about the brave Ukrainian teacher Olha Latinko, who taught her students in the eastern town of Lyman, at times just 10 miles from the front line, powered by 2 wood-burning stoves, a generator, and Starlink satellite internet. Her single-classroom school offered the handful of remaining children warmth, connection, and a bright sanctuary from war. But when I returned to Ukraine in July, Russian forces had crept closer to Lyman. Fiber optic cables from constant Russian and Ukrainian droves crisscrossed the town. Ms. Latinko's phone was out of service. She and her class were likely forced to leave. And the next one is from Johannesburg, and it's written by Ryan Lenora Brown. The sticky juice of a popsicle dribbling down my hand. The prickle of chlorine in my nose. An orchestra of crickets on warm evenings. These are feelings I associate with summer, the months of June, July, and August. So when I moved to Johannesburg a decade ago, the sight of kids in uniforms walking to school during those months, hands braided over the chest to keep warm against the winter chill, jarred me. But that's how hemispheres work, and school schedules naturally rotate around the seasons. I still haven't gotten used to the school year starting in January or spring break brushing up against Halloween. Some part of me will always be hardwired to see September as back to school season, the moment life resets and begins anew. And now for 11 pages of back to school articles. Well, here we are. The first one. After the college left, a town reimagines learning. Small colleges are closing across the U.S. in Vermont. One community turned a shuttered campus into a different type of education destination. This is written by Olivia Fletcher, who is a staff writer. From Plainfield, Vermont, voices bounce off century-old farmhouse walls as actors rehearse for a theater production. Amid the gardens outside, picnic tables fill with attendees of a week-long writing retreat. And across the grounds, students at a therapeutic school rest in the shade of a tree. This scene among the pines and mountains of a small central Vermont town reveals how Plainfield, with a population of nearly 1,000 people, is finding a way to solve a problem vexing communities across the United States. Just 2 years ago, this buzzing commons was an empty college campus. Goddard College is one of nearly 2,000 federally funded higher educational institutions that have closed over the past 30 years, and one of 17 four-year private nonprofit colleges to shut their doors in 2024 alone. Small, private, rural colleges are most susceptible to closures due to a combination of declining birth rates and students increasingly choosing the labor market or urban institutions, experts say. These numbers are only expected to grow. The Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education predicts that the number of high school graduates will steadily decline until 2041, reflecting a drop in births after 2007. This will likely lead to fewer traditional college applicants and more college closures. The communities these institutions call home often bear the economic, social, and cultural effects of their closures. Plainfield is working to restore what it lost by partnering with a private investor and the state to reinvent Goddard College as a vibrant community hub. The creative campus at Goddard redefines learning as something rooted in collaboration, creativity, and continuous growth, offering one model for other struggling college towns. Just the act of interacting with others on challenging topics does wonders to develop remarkable people, says Robert Kelchin, professor and head of the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. As was mentioned in the From the Editors column, here's another one of those questions that was asked of a child. The question's always the same. What are your top tips for someone starting high school? Be yourself from day one. You will attract the right people to be friends with, so do not worry. Make sure to surround yourself with people that you feel comfortable, safe, and yourself with when you are around them. Do not be peer pressured and set out on your own and do you. Doing good and the right thing attracts people. That was from Leah, who's in 10th grade. Back to our regularly scheduled program. Trying to fill a cultural hole. Colleges are often one of the largest employers in rural communities, Dr. Kelchin says. When they close, not only do faculty and staff lose their jobs, but the surrounding economy suffers as local businesses lose customers, which can trigger cascading job losses, prolonged economic depression, and population decline. But college closures don't just leave this economic hole. They leave a cultural hole in the community as well, Dr. Kelchin says. Nathan Grahi, professor of economics at Carleton College in Minnesota, says the students as well as the campus employees and their families can strengthen local K-12 schools, for example. The creative campus in Plainfield hopes to reimagine this cultural and intellectual life that Goddard College once brought. After Goddard closed its doors in spring of 2024, Michael Davidson, founder of New Hampshire-based property rental company Ledgeworks Incorporated, bought the 131-acre campus for $3.4 million. He worked alongside town members and the select board to understand their aspirations and needs for the space and has redeveloped it for community use. The partnership now acts as an umbrella lessee, overlooking other nonprofits that rent campus buildings, including youth support organizations, a community radio station, and a sustainable food network. Mr. Davidson and the Creative Campus Board, many of whom are former Goddard faculty members, continue to create a space for people of all ages to live, convene, and learn. In the former Goddard mailroom, where students once collected letters and packages, neighbors now gather for dinner at the new restaurant. The campus Rose Garden has traded silence for the sounds of weddings and concerts. Colorful buildings that once housed Goddard students are now available to Vermont youth in need. The property's manor house, once a Goddard College library and event space, now serves as a rehearsal space for the Goddard Institute of Dramatic Arts. Barbara Vacar, former Goddard president and now board member of the Creative Campus, and Chris Gruen, director of the Creative Campus and Haybarn Theater Arts, say Creative Campus, the Creative Campus, repurposing works because it breaks down the historic divide between a college and its community. Rather than turning inward during difficult times, the campus meets genuine needs. But the learning continues. Favor Ellis, Executive Director of Elevate Youth Services, a youth well-being and development nonprofit, found kinship through the integrated campus community. Proximity matters, Mr. Ellis says. It tells a young person, without anyone having to say it out loud, that they belong somewhere ordinary and alive, not somewhere set apart for people who need fixing. As the campus fills with new people and purpose, another idea has taken shape. Education doesn't have to end when a college closes. The Creative Campus team emphasizes lifelong learning, project-based learning, and learning by doing. The hope is that learning happens in living in the community also, Ms. Vicar says, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a course that's being offered, but there is this kind of informal learning that happens when you live in a community. Actors and writers swap stories, for example. Nonprofit staff on campus share advice with other organizations. Ms. Vicar and Mr. Gruen emphasize that while this model of repurposing is working at Goddard, there's no one-size-fits-all solution for towns that lose colleges. They believe successful campus repurposing requires collaboration, a coordinated system of state support and funding, and a private owner who understands regional needs. I think this is a moment where we all have to put our real collaboration and creativity into thinking and let go of our attachments to what has been and really ask what can be now, Ms. Vicar says. All right, their next article in the Back to School section is entitled Parents Push for Less YouTube, More Books in Schools. A backlash against technology in schools is growing as concerns mount over screen time. This is written by Stephanie Cook Broadhurst, who is a contributor. From Evanston, Illinois, Miriam Kendall has never gotten her children an iPad. She doesn't allow screens at home except for limited TV time. So when her oldest daughter was handed a tablet in kindergarten, it felt to her like opening a Pandora's box. She came home and said, "Mommy, you have to let me watch YouTube," recalls the mother of three from Evanston, Illinois. Ms. Kendall, who encourages her children to play outside and not on devices, held the line on her household rule. But when her daughter entered second grade, Ms. Kendall found something concerning when she checked the school tablet's tracker. Her daughter had spent 2 hours watching Taylor Swift videos at school when she should have been learning. She wondered, did the school have a clear policy on technology use? She reached out to other parents who shared her concerns. Today, Ms. Kendall, founder and director of parent group Screen Sense Evanston, is leading the charge in her neighborhood and with others nationwide to unplug kids from devices in classrooms. She speaks at school board meetings and lobbies for screen time limits and a return to pencil and paper learning, particularly in elementary grades. "We want there to be a really thoughtful and strategic reevaluation of the use of technology in schools," says Ms. Kendall, who launched a petition last year to limit screen time that garnered over 1,400 signatures in her local pre-K through 8th grade district of about 6,000 students. This is widespread. Parents are demanding change. Indeed, parents from California to Illinois to Pennsylvania are pushing back against technology they say creates distractions, negatively impacts learning, and conflicts with screen time limits set at home. Many had heeded the advice of Jonathan Haidt's best-selling book, The Anxious Generation, to limit digital exposure, only to find themselves undermined by the place that is supposed to be most attuned to child development, the classroom. How in the world are you providing these highly addictive, highly distracting devices to every single student in the district? Asks Ms. Kendall, who wants to see clearer policies and more staff training. And now back to one of our PSAs. What are your top tips for someone starting high school? Don't forget to love yourself, especially when with pressures of social media. You're God's perfect image, and that cannot change. That's from Karina, who's in 7th grade. And now back to our regular scheduled programming. From a tech surge to growing caution. A decade ago, many districts across the United States raced to close the homework gap and digital divide as educators viewed technology as essential for preparing students for a modern world. They signed multi-year contracts with technology companies and invested billions of dollars into digital tools, such as iPads and Chromebooks. In 2020, the pandemic accelerated the trend as districts used federal coronavirus relief fund money to invest in technology and remote learning. When students returned to classrooms, parents had hoped to trade tablets for textbooks as it became clear technology could not replace in-person learning. Today, many school districts still have not fully recovered from historic academic declines in student achievement due to school closures and remote learning, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Nobody stepped back after COVID and took a fresh look at the use case for the iPad and the school policies and said, is this the optimal way to use the tool? Says parent Aaron Friedman of Glenview, Illinois, who launched a petition to limit devices last spring that garnered 1,000 signatures. In spring of 2020, about 45% of public schools assigned devices to individual students, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. By the 2024 to 2025 school year, that figure had nearly doubled. By around 88% of public schools had a ratio of one-to-one computing programs, which provide every student with a school-issued device. Organizers point to growing evidence that shows excessive screen time harms children, including a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services advisory issued in May, linking it to poor student well-being. Many of these parents helped drive the national Wait Until 8th pledge movement to delay smartphones until 8th grade, which over 155,000 families have signed. They're also mobilizing to support school-wide cell phone bans. At least 37 states now require school districts to ban or restrict student cell phone use during class time, according to Education Week. At school board meetings across the U.S., parents have reported kids playing video games in class and students watching pre-recorded lessons instead of learning from a teacher. Part of the solution, parents say, is to let students dig in the dirt during science class or leaf through a library book during English. Parent Jordan Spickelmeyer from Morton, Illinois, runs a device-free home for her first-grade son and a 2-year-old daughter. She understands that screens can play a role in learning, but she wonders, are they better than human teachers? Ms. Spickelmeyer points to how some learning gaps are designed to be highly addictive. She's concerned ed tech companies are profiting from children's education and prefers to use paper flashcards with students she tutors instead of quiz apps that often have pop-up ads. Internet Safety Labs, a nonprofit research group, reported in 2022 that 96% of educational apps share children's data with third parties, often unbeknownst to students, parents, or schools. Educators suggest the question isn't whether technology belongs in classrooms, but how it's used. Research shows digital tools can improve literacy and STEM comprehension when used with teacher oversight. A 2024 meta-analysis across 119 studies in the Review of Educational Research looked at EdTech's effects on literacy in K through 5 grades and found positive outcomes for reading comprehension and writing proficiency. But some parents want more to say in how their children learn, including the right to remove their students from screen-based instruction. Parents in the Lower Merion School District in Pennsylvania drew national attention in June when yelling broke out at a board meeting after the district repealed a policy that had given families a choice to opt out. Many districts, including Lower Merion, are re-examining their policies. After facing pressure from parents and the group Schools Beyond Screens, the Los Angeles Unified School District in June approved a ban on classroom screen time for students through first grade, while gradually increasing access in higher grade levels. Meanwhile, at least 16 states have introduced or enacted legislation to limit screen time or take a closer look at ed tech policies. Since launching her petition in Evanston, Ms. Kendall says her district has banned YouTube and over 300 non-educational apps from school-based devices. The district also agreed to screen-free indoor recess, she says. The Evanston Skokie School, District 65, did not respond to requests for comment. When Mr. Friedman brought parents' concerns to his school board in Glenview last spring, they listened. Our district takes this very seriously, says Mr. Friedman, who has a third grader. Within a matter of weeks, they came back and instituted meaningful changes, he says, including a decision to review and clarify appropriate use policies for technology in classrooms. Parents agree technology, when properly supervised, can help students conduct research, take online exams, or learn multimedia skills. College student Nadia Easley from Northbrook, Illinois, learned how to type and code in middle school at a private school, Willows Academy. But getting taught by humans is what she remembers most. She grew to love her least favorite subject, history, thanks to a teacher who made the class engaging. A survey of 600 U.S. teachers in May found that 85% believe students spend too much time on screens in class, according to researchers at Auburn University College of Education and Christopher Newport University. It's soft skills that matter, and those are learned face-to-face with good in-person interactions, says Kim Whitman, a parent from Overland Park, Kansas, and organizers with Distraction-Free Schools Policy Project. Kids coming out of school need to be able to speak to people and look them in the eye. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for another of these back-to-school articles. Education's AI gold rush comes with risks. As Silicon Valley titans and startups cash in, educators and parents struggle to decide which tools help and harm. This is written by Aaron Glantz, who is a staff writer. Across the United States, financially strapped school districts are spending increasing amounts of money on artificial intelligence products, despite a growing body of research showing AI can harm children's ability to think. Education's AI sector, virtually non-existent before ChatGPT's release in 2022, grew to $730 million in 2026, according to a report prepared for the Monitor by Future Market Insights. The research firm projects the market for AI in K-12 education will grow by 40% annually for the next decade, reaching $18.5 billion in 2036. The beneficiaries, observers say, are a growing list of companies with names like Magic School, School AI, and Buddy. They seek to profit from a quandary increasingly facing educators. Students and teachers are already using AI, but not always in a way that facilitates learning. My students can put a homework question into Google and the AI summary will give them the answer, says Merrick Chang, who teaches chemistry and biology at Los Altos High School in the San Gabriel Valley outside of Los Angeles. The tech companies say their specialized AI products provide the solution. AI can help teachers write lesson plans and grade papers, saving them time, the companies say, while personalized learning bots cater to students' individual needs and produce spectacular academic gains. But without a significant body of research proving these tools' efficacy, and some studies showing harm, a growing number of experts are worried that children have become the guinea pigs of the next big tech experiment. There has been an absolute gold rush, says Chris Hagel, chief information officer at the Peninsula School District outside Tacoma, Washington. Meanwhile, frontier AI firms from Anthropic and OpenAI have announced they are offering their Claude and ChatGPT products to educators for free, but only temporarily. Anthropic's commitment to complimentary service for educators expires June 2027. OpenAI's expires in June 2028. Here's another one of these public service announcements. What is your most important tip for someone going into a new school? It can be scary, but love yourself. That's from Karina in a seventh grade. Back to our regularly scheduled programming. They want to capture the market. We've seen this many times before, says Chris Agnew, director of the Generative AI for Education Hub at Stanford University. In an interview, OpenAI's Vice President of Education, Lee Belsky, declined to speculate on whether ChatGPT would remain free for educators, but she said helping teachers is part of the company's mission. Anthropic did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Balancing promise with peril. According to the Center for Democracy and Technology, an estimated 85% of teachers and 86% of students already utilized generative AI in their schoolwork. The Trump administration has pushed school districts to incorporate AI. In July 2025, the Department of Education, which Mr. Trump seeks to dismantle, issued guidance that encourages educators to harness the potential of AI by utilizing high-quality AI instructional materials and deploying AI-enhanced high-impact tutoring. But the department has not set standards to help local officials vet these tools. In April of 2025, Education Secretary Linda McMahon elicited cackles from the administration's critics when she mistakenly referred to AI as A1 in a speech at Arizona State University. Without federal standards, more than 30 states have adopted their own guidelines. A few, including Wyoming and North Carolina, have provided districts with robust frameworks to balance the technology's promise with its peril. Part of Wyoming's guidance is a video on the state's Department of Education website titled Threat Assessment. It begins with a warning, AI is already here, it says, inside the ed tech tools you're probably already paying for, before adding that without federal standards, this job just got harder. Because all the responsibility for checking every single tool for safety, for privacy, for whether it even works, that now falls squarely on you. The video then lays a laundry list of red flags, from apps that collect data on students to those that target them with advertisements to those that may harm their ability to learn. Wyoming's Department of Education also provides vetting tools to districts. One of them, developed by Project Unicorn, a consortium of nonprofit organizations and school associations, is a chat box that evaluates other AI applications. Project Unicorn's website includes its own disclaimer. While every effort has been made to ensure accuracy and relevance, please treat all information as guidance and informational rather than final legal, technical, or purchasing advice. The lack of clarity around the new technology has opened the door for corruptions, some worry. On June 21st, Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent Alberto Carvalho resigned after his home was raided by the FBI amid an investigation into a district contract for an AI chatbot. 2 weeks later, in New York, school's Chancellor Kamar Samuels asked principals to pause purchases of AI software after New York City Council members demanded a moratorium on AI's use in schools until rigorous guardrails can be developed with public and expert input to prevent serious damage to NYC children and their future. A broader petition seeking a 2-year moratorium on generative AI use in the city schools has generated thousands of signatures. Industry's sunny vision. In Silicon Valley, a rising cadre of founders offers a far sunnier version or vision of AI's impact on education, exhibiting characteristically brash confidence when issuing bold statements about their technology's power to uplift children and transform learning. Among the competing startups is Bloomy, an AI learning bot developed by Alex Southmade, a former McKinsey & Company consultant. Mr. Southmade once recruited drivers for Lyft, the ride-hauling company. Now he is building Bloomy at Y Combinator, the San Francisco tech incubator that has helped launch a long list of Silicon Valley titans, including Airbnb and DoorDash. Why have a teacher lecture 30 students at once when each student can receive a customized lesson that's perfect for them? Mr. Southmaid asks. He imagines a world where students receive AI-enabled personalized instruction from his Bloomy app, gamified through the receipt of Bloomy Bucks for correct answers to be redeemed with a teacher. Mr. Southmaid said he knows parents are worried about the damaging effect excessive screen time can have on their children, but he argues his app is good for kids' development. Social media, as well as many ed tech platforms, erodes focus and mental resilience, he says. We structure the experience so that students find satisfaction in effort, patience, and mastery rather than passive consumption. Mr. Southmaid says pilot results, mostly in charter schools, show his app improves student performance in both writing and math. But like most of its competitors, Bloomy's performance has not been subject to randomized controlled trials that compare it to regular school instruction. According to Stanford's Mr. Agnew, the effectiveness of personalized learning chatbots has yet to be independently established by researchers. Very few rigorous studies have even been conducted, he says. I have not seen anything that shows we can replace the human teacher, nor should we, he adds. Indeed, Mr. Agnew's center at Stanford has documented a performance cliff born of intellectual outsourcing to AI. While students using unrestricted AI show immediate performance improvement while using AI agents, their performance plummets once the tool is removed. Education experts say, this is in line with what we're learning about the impact of AI use among adults. In February, a team of researchers from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business published a study that found the use of artificial intelligence was reshaping human reasoning and leading to cognitive surrender. The study involved 1,300 participants and 10,000 trials. Robbie Torney, head of digital and AI assessments for the nonprofit Common Sense Media, says school districts should remember the fundamentals of what's known to work in education. A sense of belonging, connection to a teacher, and connection to community, which motivates students to learn. Mr. Southmaid counters that his company does not seek to replace teachers, but wants to free them up for more one-on-one instructions. I don't know any teacher who feels they have too much time, he says. No firm is better positioned to benefit from the growth of AI in education than Google, which has gifted millions of Chromebook laptops to children and whose software suite, Google Classroom, is already used by most school districts. With minimal fanfare, Google has integrated its Gemini and Notebook LM AI tools into the Google Classroom suite. Consumer testing of Gemini by the nonprofit group Common Sense Media, however, found the version of Gemini being made available to schools has the same safety problems as the consumer version. The group rated Gemini for schools high risks. Among other things, Common Sense Media found Gemini's K-12 chatbot treats a sixth grader the same as a high school senior, providing identical responses despite vast developmental differences, and can surface inappropriate content. Gemini also allows students to seamlessly switch back and forth between the school version, which is designed to teach, and the consumer version, which will simply give them the answer. Google declined to request to comment on Common Sense Media findings and did not respond to the substance of 8 questions posed by the monitor. Instead, the company spokesperson, Maggie Shields, replied with a statement. We know AI raises important questions, it read. That's why we build with educators and experts to ensure our AI is helpful, safe by design, and grounded in pedagogy and how people actually learn. We believe technology, when used effectively with educators in the lead, unlocks student potential. The company added that school administrators have the power to turn Gemini off. Uncertainty in the classroom. Mr. Agnew said early research findings have been more positive when it comes to AI's deployment as a resource for teachers, such as assisting in drafting a lesson of lesson plans or analyzing individual students' needs. AI can reduce teacher time spent on routine tasks with no evidence of quality loss, according to a report his center published. AI can also be effective in streamlining administrative tasks, such as scheduling school buses, Mr. Agnew says. At the Peninsula School District outside Tacoma, Mr. Hagel says he has developed AI assistants that help teachers take attendance, write up summaries of playground fights, and hone financial analyses. Common Sense Media ranks these tasks as lower risk than the deployment of AI for classroom instructions, but there are concerns nonetheless. AI can be biased, Mr. Torney says. They have been found to give women different salary negotiation advice than men and produce different evaluations of the same resume when only the name at the top has changed. Mr. Torney says his organization has found similar discrepancies when using AI to grade school assignments. When the AI chatbot grades the same paper hundreds of times, it does not always provide the same grade. The result can also be different depending on the race and gender most commonly associated with the name at the top. Classroom teachers are often left to navigate this themselves. Mr. Chang told the Monitor there has been no mandatory professional development AI training for teachers in his district. He says his focus has been on building AI literacy to help his students better understand how the technology works. In a recent chemistry class, he asked his students, 90% of whom are Latino and 80% of whom qualify for free or reduced price lunch, to pick a substance of their choice and investigate its molecular structure. One picked the styling product, pomade. "What is the molecular structure of pomade that it allows you to keep your hair up?" he asked the bot. Together, they work through questions about double bonds and single bonds, chemistry concepts that we're learning in class, and how that might work in the real world. Typically, the way they use AI, it's like a Google search. You type in your question and you get some kind of output, Mr. Chang says. This way, you have to define what your input is and get information from a verified source. So we have to understand what a trustworthy source is and get in that mindset. I can't imagine a future of AI and what it might look like, Mr. Chang says, but as a teacher, I can't ignore it. And we have another one of these back-to-school articles. Don't just believe. Look. Sal Khan, the founder of Khan Academy, is arguably the most visible figure in U.S. education. He's drawn praise from figures such as Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and former First Lady Michelle Obama. His 2011 TED Talk on reinventing education garnered more than 6 million views, and his free online tutorials have racked up billions of views on YouTube. So, observers took notice when, in May of 2023, Mr. Khan declared in another TED Talk that artificial intelligence represented probably the biggest positive transformation that education has ever seen. He understood that AI could help students cheat, but he also argued it was capable of personalizing lessons for every student, essentially providing every child with a customized digital tutor. Mr. Khan developed a chatbot called Khanmigo after being given early access to ChatGPT. He touted the tool in a 60 Minutes television segment with Anderson Cooper, was featured in the book AI for Good by Atlantic staff writer Josh Tyrangeil, and penned his own book, Brave New Words, How AI Will Revolutionize Education, and in parentheses, and why that's a good thing. But the revolution has not yet materialized the way Mr. Khan predicted. In an April interview with the news site ChalkBeat, the YouTube star acknowledged that for a lot of students, Khanmigo was a non-event. Many just don't use it much, he said. Still, he remains bullish on AI's future in education. He sat down with Monitor AI Bureau Chief Aaron Glantz in July. Here are excerpts from their conversation, lightly edited for clarity and brevity. So here's this question and answer thing. First question from Aaron Glantz. When I started reporting on AI and education, everyone pointed me to you because you were working with ChatGPT before it was known to most people. So I'm curious, what have you learned over the past few years? And Sal Khan says, from the beginning, we were very careful that the AI wouldn't give answers, that it would be Socratic. It would nudge you forward. It would provide teachers and parents with transparency as to what was going on. But what we realized is that for a lot of students, just having that extra layer of support wasn't enough. Imagine I walk into a classroom and I say, "Hey kids, my name is Sal. I think I'm a pretty good tutor. I'm just going to sit in the back of the room here, and if any of you have any questions, I'm happy to help you. Well, you can imagine what would happen. Some of the kids maybe would leverage it, but a lot of kids might be too embarrassed. They wouldn't know how to do it. So now the question is, the easiest thing for the student to do is cut and paste in the Google searches AI summary, and they'll have the answer. You're offering a different path, but students didn't necessarily engage in the way that you had hoped, right? And he goes, "Yeah. When we launched Conmigo in 2023, we were already acutely aware ChatGPT was going to be a cheating nightmare. We had observed kids in classrooms doing Khan Academy. Then they'd go to another ed tech tool that the district is paying for, throw the Khan Academy question into that, and get the answer. But I was thinking, okay, what if we had resources? What would a human do? At some point, I should go walk up to the students and observe what they're doing. When they get a question wrong, they might be embarrassed to ask me. But what if I went proactively to that student and said, 'Look, Billy, I saw that you just got that question wrong. Why don't you and I work on that a little bit?' That's essentially what we have evolved into. We piloted a new version last year, and now we're rolling it out to millions of students around the country. When you get a question wrong, the AI says, 'Hey, why don't you work with me a little bit on this question?' And the teacher can then say, 'If you show me that you really understand it, I'll give you credit for it.'" And then a question here is, "But you have to get the student to actually engage with the bot and want to learn." I guess that's a statement. And his response is, "Exactly. What you're describing is not unique to AI. I hate to say it, even putting all technology aside, there's a lot of classrooms where kids are pretending to pay attention. This is why we have been partnering with teachers and districts closely, because we see that when teachers make it part of the assignments, that drives engagement for most students. The first version of Conmigo was completely optional. Now, it's actually in the student's incentive to work with the AI, because if the AI deems that you know it, now you'll get credit for it. Imagine a class of 30 students all working on their different things. We highlight to teachers that these 5 kids are really struggling with negative exponents. And we can now tell the teacher, you don't have to slow down all the other 25 kids, but you take these 5 kids aside and assign a tutoring session with Conmigo on negative exponents. Well, AI has problems with judgment and bias. How do you think about what AI is good for now?" And his response was, "Humans also have a lot of bias. There actually have been studies about how human beings grade students differently based on their perceptions of them. I don't say that to dismiss the fears of AI. I just want to say that the bar shouldn't be perfection. The goal is, could you have a system that's more consistent and less biased than the status quo? If you had an amazing English teacher who gives very consistent and good feedback, if that teacher has to grade 100 papers on The Great Gatsby, it's going to take them a week or two. And in many cases, the limiting factor on how much feedback you can get depends on how much bandwidth the teacher has. And the teacher is spending so much time. We do not do AI grading of full papers yet, but we do have a system that gives AI feedback on papers. And I do think in the next year it will be possible to do pretty solid Rubik's-based grading. The benefit of a technical system is that you can benchmark it. You can't test it for bias, checking whether details like a family's cultural background in any way change the feedback that is given." And the final statement or question here is, "We don't really have a centralized education system, and local school officials and teachers often lack information they need to make a smart decision about AI." And his final response is, "What you're describing is very real. I've been telling every university and every school district, regardless of whether they're using Khan Academy or if they want to go completely non-tech or not, I'm like, assume kids are using AI for any take-home assignment. Even in a classroom, like when kids are on a computer screen, You need to very carefully monitor what they're doing. Even things as basic as Google are AI now. If you leave a laptop on kids' desks all day, nothing good's going to happen. What we should say is, okay, we want these kids to learn math, get a lot of reading comprehension practice, write a lot, and get a lot of feedback, and let the teacher spend energy on the human work of teaching, things no technology can do. You can use technology like Khan Academy to drive personalized practice. Don't just believe. Look at things that have a base of evidence. For example, we work closely with Newark Public Schools. They've been deep with Khan Academy for about 4 years, and Khan Academy is a major part of why Newark is now seeing 3 times the growth in math compared to the state of New Jersey, despite being one of the state's poorer districts. It's because of the way they have integrated the tech with human teachers. Okay, we got some more of these public service announcements where they ask kids the same question. What is your most important tip for someone going into a new school? To be open to all kinds of people. Don't make up your mind about someone until you've actually met them. That was a combined response from Sophie and Allie, who are in the 11th grade. Here's another one. What are your top tips for someone starting high school? I think surround yourself with good people who want the best for you and who encourage you to be your authentic self. And that was from Reagan, who's in the 11th grade. And here's another one. What's your best advice for a kid starting middle school? Make sure that you have everything you need and be willing to try new things. Be curious and ask questions about things you are unsure about. This is a huge part in one's life that allows someone to be creative and find stuff that they are passionate about. Finding supportive friends is a big part in finding out the kind of person you are or want to be. These friends could possibly last forever, so express good qualities. That was the advice from Hazel, who's in 11th grade. And I think there might be another one. Hey, what's your best advice for a kid starting in middle school? You are not the only one. I was homeschooled last year for 7th grade, but this year I will be going to 8th grade for the first time. No one is alone. That's from Evie from 8th grade. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor Weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.